This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Election season is upon us, and that means voters will face a ballot full of statewide candidates vying for seats in North Carolina's Council of State. 10 elected positions are part of the council, including the governor, lieutenant governor, and others. How much do you know about the 8 other positions and what each elected official's role entails? Well, here to help us with all of that, Council of State positions, is Chris Cooper, Department Head of Political Science and Public Affairs at Western Carolina University. Chris, welcome to the State of Things.
Thanks. Great to talk to you.
Talking about these 10 positions, I tell you what, will you name them for us?
Sure. It's the governor, the lieutenant governor, secretary of state, auditor, treasurer, superintendent of public instruction, attorney general, commissioner of agriculture, labor, and then insurance.
How does this council differ from the North Carolina cabinet?
Yeah, so this is, I'm really glad you asked that. It's a confusing thing, right? So we have a council of state, which are these 10 elected executive level offices. And then we have the cabinet, which conveniently is also about 10 folks who are appointed. And our council of state, initially in our very first constitution in North Carolina, these folks actually were appointed. And then we started electing them in 1868. And then it got even more confusing. So by 1967, the News and Observer was saying that the governor has so many boards and committees and everything else that he can, quote, hardly remember their names, let alone coordinate their work. So if you're a voter and you're confused, folks are thinking the governor was confused as well. So in the 1971 Constitution, our last one, the one we have now, there was actually a good bit of debate about whether we should be electing these folks when we may not know as much. But ultimately, of course, we decided to keep the current system, and so we do still have these 10 elected folks.
It is a system that is unusual across the nation, right? I mean, these are really executive positions for the most part, and for most states, they are appointed positions, are they not?
You know, that's exactly right. I mean, it is a peculiar system, to say the least. And again, it's a hard thing, I think, for voters to understand why one office might be in the cabinet and why another office might be in the Council of State and what the difference between those things are. So it's peculiar. It's worked well for us as a state. I think it's good to give folks a chance to weigh in on our bureaucracy and how our government's run. But it does certainly lead to long ballots and a lot of confusion.
Well, and also, I mean, in terms of what the executive does, it has the effect then of obviously giving the governor somewhat less authority. So the governor of your state, because these aren't appointed positions, has less executive power in a sense, right?
That's exactly right. North Carolina has one of the least powerful governors in the United States. We were the last state in the country to give our governor the veto power about a century after other folks did. And so, yes, we traditionally have a fairly weak executive, a weak governor, and this is part of the reason why and part of the kind of illustration as to how that plays out today.
All right, and we're talking about these elected positions, obviously, because we're in the election season, but give us a sense of then what is the cabinet and over whom and what departments does the governor have direct authority?
Right, so the cabinet, we've got things like correction, Department of Administration, Department of Revenue, Department of Transportation, Department of Commerce. So some critical, State Board of Elections, certainly. So we've got some real critical offices. And again, for voters, I think can be confusing. The State Board of Elections is obviously a great example. In a lot of states, that function falls under the Attorney General, the Secretary of State. And that is not true in North Carolina. Our Secretary of State does not, in fact, oversee elections.
Historically, then, how has this gone? Because we've been doing this, as you suggest, for a long, long time. These have been elected positions. Do these positions tend to be independent of party? How do voters research them, and how have voters, how have they voted in the past?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting one. So in 2016, so one thing we might expect to see is a lot of what a political scientist might call ballot roll-off. In other words, you start at the top of the ticket. By the time you get to the bottom, you're not really so sure, and so you just kind of take a pass and don't fill those out. The ballot roll-off was about 5% for these. In other words, about 95% of the people in 2016 who voted for president also cast a vote for most of these Council of State offices. I'm excluding the governor and lieutenant governor from that. We've tended to vote overwhelmingly for the Democratic Party. That's not true right now. Currently, 6 of our 10 Council of State folks are Republicans, but traditionally, it's been overwhelmingly Democratic. We've only had 11 Republicans on our Council of State since 1900. So 10 positions over 100 years, 11 Republicans total. So this has definitely been one of the last bastions of Democratic dominance in our state until very recently. It's also been very male dominated. So we've only had 8 women who have served on our Council of State, again, since 1900, 10 different positions.
And I can only guess, if we go back that far, racial diversity is probably not in evidence or has not been historically. Would I be right?
You would absolutely be right. So this is a great example of where our government and our elected officials don't always look like and sort of descriptively represent the people of the state of North Carolina.
So now we know the roles of governor and lieutenant governor have term limits. What about the positions in the Council of State? How many times can an incumbent be reelected?
They can keep running and keep running and keep running. And we've certainly seen that, right? We have some folks who have kind of virtual dynasties in North Carolina politics and have held these positions for a long time. Of course, our Secretary of Labor right now, Sheree Berry, has been in for a number of terms. I believe it's 5 4-year terms, thanks to, for a lot of reasons, but certainly her presence on everybody's elevator, as we know, is part of that. So yes, you can create a dynasty in some of these Council of State offices in a way that you can't in many other offices in North Carolina. And I think that's the other electoral pattern we see, is that because people don't know much, the incumbency advantage is much, much stronger. In other words, you may have some faint recognition of a name of somebody who's been on the ballot before, and so that's going to give them an extra boost for an office like this.
Well, let's take some time now to talk about what those roles are and what kind of impact they have on life in North Carolina. You mentioned Sheree Berry, the Commissioner of Labor. Let's start there. What is the role of the Commissioner of Labor in the state of North Carolina?
Yeah, so they regulate the workplace safety, and again, of course, elevators, right? As we all know, given the kind of free advertising that she has started to put on there, there was even a paper by a couple political scientists at UNC Chapel Hill who found that counties with more elevators per capita, she actually had a greater vote share. So that seems to have done some good. But beside the elevators, these are really critically important roles, again, regulating the workplace, workplace safety, workers' rights, all sorts of issues that matter to all of us.
Now, you talked about the fact that in many cases, these, because we don't exactly know the role of these offices, because there are other key races on the ballot on any given year, people might not be paying attention. But what happens when, for instance, worker safety, makes the headlines, as it has over the, particularly the COVID age, but it has recently? Does that tend to, do people then stand up and make the connection? They say, oh, these worker safety things, they're connected to this particular office, for instance.
Yeah, a little bit, but not. These patterns aren't really evident in the voting data. So it really doesn't appear that there is kind of higher turnout when those are more salient topics. It sort of stays relatively constant. So you're going to see higher turnout for things like governor and lieutenant governor. And on down the ticket, you're going to see, again, about 95%. And I know I keep referring to it almost as a laugh line, but this elevator thing really is critical. Labor has actually seen a higher turnout than some of the others, and there is evidence to suggest that she has higher name recognition than other folks do because of this advertising. So I think what that tells us for how democracy runs is that you can break through and you can let people know what your office does and how you're important. You've just got to put it in their face, whether that is in an elevator or in an advertisement in other ways.
Well, I mean, or not let them know what you do, but make sure they see your face and your name. I mean, I think that's one of the more interesting things about the elevator thing. It doesn't really talk about any of the issues. So that becomes an important kind of question. Let's talk about a higher profile position, maybe one that people are paying more attention to, voters in general. Let's say the role of attorney general. Let's talk about what the AG is responsible for.
sure. Yeah, this person's the head of the Department of Justice. They represent the state, of course. We've got Josh Stein, who is in that role now. We've had Roy Cooper, who was in that role before. So this is one that tends to be more prominent. You tend to see larger fundraising numbers. And this is one that I think folks do know more about. There's a little bit less ballot roll-off for that level as well.
Let's talk about lieutenant governor as well, because here we have a case now in the state of North Carolina where we have the governor is a Democrat and the lieutenant governor is a Republican. They're running against each other right now for governor. What about the role of lieutenant governor?
Yeah, so this is one, you know, it's a little bit akin to the vice president of the United States, but if there was no guarantee that the vice president was always of the same party as the president. So this is somebody who is, of course, a member of the executive and legislative branches, the only person that is. They break ties in the legislative branch. They also serve on a number of boards. But there's not really one specific policy area that folks associate with lieutenant governor.
You know, it's so fascinating, though. I wonder if this is peculiar to North Carolina and its strange voting patterns. This is the state that put Jim Hunt in the governor's office, in the governor's mansion, the same year it elected Jesse Helms to the U.S. Senate. But presumably the same voters were in the poll voting for each of those men when they did. And so I think about voting for a Democratic governor and a Republican lieutenant governor, again, same voters. Is that something, is that a North Carolina thing?
You know, it is a North Carolina thing, and it's happened a couple of times in our history, and now is, of course, one of them. And I think it is because we are a purple state, or as I heard Jeff Tiberi say a little bit ago, we are a squishy state. We're a state that is kind of hard to pin down. We're a tough tiger to catch by the tail. And so there still are some voters who do split their ticket. There are more voters, I think, in our state that split tickets more than in other states throughout the South or throughout the country. So, yeah, that is a bit of a peculiarity of North Carolina politics.
You know, the squishy state actually came in second for our license plate. So you should be happy that it didn't win. Let's talk about, now here's another position that agriculture and agribusiness, certainly very important to the North Carolina economy. Everybody in the state gets to vote on the agriculture secretary, 17% of North Carolina jobs, according to NC state statistics. That's a few years ago. So that's a big job. Do people pay attention? Is it a competitive race or has it been?
Yeah, so it has been a competitive race. It used to be very competitive. And so it was, in some ways, in North Carolina's political history, one of the major springboards to higher office. So Rob Christensen, who folks are probably familiar with, who's a longtime State House reporter, has a book, The Rise and Fall of the Branchhead Boys, where he talks about how Kerr Scott's rise in North Carolina politics was partially due to the fact that he was in charge of agriculture for the state. It was able to be prominent. It still matters. It's still incredibly important for our state. It is perhaps a little bit less important than it used to be. But these folks are over crop statistics, regulating our food supply. They're the head of the Department of Agriculture. Heck, they're even in charge of the North Carolina State Fair.
How much, what about labor, though? Let's say migrant workers, for instance. Does that fall under the labor, agriculture department?
So it depends on which piece we're talking about here, right? If we're talking about the kind of the labor rights piece, of course, it would fall under labor. If we're talking about how migrant workers work to work with crops and regulate the food supply and things like that, then it would fall under agriculture. And I think it's a good example of where sometimes the policy areas have to adopt over time, right? We've had these structures in place for a number of years, and as new issues come up, sometimes it's not real clear where they fall.
You know, I wonder if these issues change and as times change, you would think about the agriculture secretary would be, or commissioner would be, someone who would be a popular race in rural areas, maybe less important in urban areas. But I'm wondering, as the debate over industrialized agriculture versus a more local agri-system becomes more current, and as people become more aware of food systems across the state, if people pay attention to that race in a different way, or does it still kind of default to the same kind of arguments?
You know, I think it defaults. I mean, it is it's a tough thing just to make voters aware of your who's running for governor, who's running for the U.S. Senate, who's running for Congress, who's running for the General Assembly, who's running for offices down the line. And so I would like to think that voters would you know, think critically about things like agriculture and the Department of Agriculture and who we're electing here. But I think incumbency, name recognition, party ID, they really do matter. And in defense of North Carolina voters, it is an awful long ballot in our state, and it is longer than it is in many other states. And so it is no small feat to even memorize what these folks do, much less what their relative positions are on those issues.
Well, another very important one that affects everybody in the state, public education, obviously looking very different this year than in past elections. So what about the impact on the race or of the race for Secretary of Public Instruction?
Yeah, this one is critical, and it does tend to be one that has a little bit more salience to most voters, certainly if you have kids. We've all at least been a kid and been through school, so certainly that one can matter a little bit more. Sort of around the country, it's interesting, this is a position that women tend to do a little bit better in. So there's a political science paper by one of my colleagues, Jessica Hayden, and some of her co-authors, where they show that women tend to fare better in elections for public instruction than they do for many of these other cabinet-style positions, because folks tend to associate that with female candidates.
Let's talk about some of the other candidates and some of the other positions as well. I mean, for instance, Commissioner of Insurance.
Yeah, so Commissioner of Insurance is again another critical one that I think folks do not pay attention to enough. But it regulates insurance in the state, and of course, we got a couple of high-profile folks here that are in a rematch. So Mike Causey and Wayne Goodwin, of course, had a very, very tight race, like less than one percentage point in 2016, and they are racing each other again. And so we would expect that. Certainly in 2016, that was a much better year to be a Republican. We'll see which party it's better to be a member of this round.
And what are they responsible for? What's some of their duties?
Sure. Yeah, so regulating insurance. So what helps make our insurance rates greater, what helps make our insurance rates lower, just issues around insurance. It's the kind of thing that government does that we don't tend to think about or we don't tend to associate with government. But again, if you've got an insurance policy, this is critical.
No, and for people who move from out of state, I mean, I think that's when you notice, because you've had your insurance forever with a particular company, and then you move to North Carolina, you stay with the company, all of a sudden the rates go way up or way down, and they say, well, you know, the rules in North Carolina are different, that sort of thing. So it does make a difference.
It does make a difference, and I think that's what's fascinating and confusing about state politics, right? The way we do it in North Carolina really is different than the way they do it just a couple miles south.
And state auditor. I mean, we have to, you know, for people who aren't auditors for a living, they would think, well, do I really have to pay attention to that job? And here I am asked to vote about it. So tell us about the state auditor.
Sure. This is essentially the state accountant, right? So in the same way you would have an accountant for your business or for your nonprofit or perhaps for your personal finances, this person is essentially the accountant for the state of North Carolina. They're the fraud watchdog in a lot of ways. They review financial accounts. So if you want to make sure that there's not fraud rampant in your state, this is a really critical position to pay attention to.
Chris, let's talk about the treasurer's role in the Council of State. What does the treasurer do?
You know, so the treasurer, we've talked before about the auditor, so who's essentially the state accountant. The treasurer is the person who pays the bills. They're over state pension. They're over state health care. They maintain the bond rating. So essentially, they're doing the action that the auditor is later auditing.
All right. Well, our current treasurer is Dale Falwell and joins us now to talk about the position that he holds, some of the decisions he's made since taking office in 2017, a member of the Republican Party. Dale Falwell, welcome to State of Things.
Well, it's so good to be with you, and my condolences to Professor Cooper and the Hendricks family who are out in western North Carolina, a deputy who lost his life this weekend. And so our thoughts and prayers are with our friends in the mountains.
Thank you for that. The treasurer, let's talk a little bit about your position, chief financial officer and official banker for the state. Your department is responsible for managing, $110 billion in assets, and that would be the state retirement system, investments, state health insurance plans. Talk about the scope of your role.
Well, the state treasurer's office is considered by the book by former treasurer Harlan Bowles as the keeper of the public purse, and actually it's nearly $200 billion. Just the pension plan by itself is over $108 billion. That's four times larger in the state budget. And when you add in all the responsibilities as a state treasurer, we manage $200 billion, which is eight times the size of the state budget. So we're in a real position that when we succeed, all levels of government succeed because of the sheer leverage.
This leverage also, in some ways, gives you some leverage over policy. I mean, you're moving around a lot of money, and it seems to me that there is a way in which, if the state were wise, if we were all wise in our understanding of how you could use that leverage, we could have a lot more power over various markets, could we not?
Well, that's exactly right. But at the end of the day, our jobs are not always easy, but it's very simple. We have a loyalty and duty of care to those that teach, protect, and serve, and that's what our fiduciary responsibilities are. And as I said on your show before, people don't call the treasurer's office to book a cruise. They call the treasurer's office because they've had a life-changing event. Most are good, and some are bad. But that's why, we're just in an environment right now with everything going on at the treasurer's office that, you know, people just don't care anything about a political party, because at the end of the day, we deliver checks mainly to those that have taught, protected, or otherwise served.
What I'm thinking about your clear pricing project that you recommended, it was a fight over the state health insurance plan, and it was a way to use leverage to get better prices, in a sense. I mean, I think that was your position, that if you had enough leverage. Tell us about the clear pricing plan and how that would have changed the existing state health plan.
Well, 8 years ago, Bill Gates said that the single biggest threat to public education, think of how all your listeners would answer that question, the single biggest threat to public education is how states and locals fund and account for health care and pension costs. And then a year ago, Warren Buffett, his bridge partner, said that rising health care costs are the tapeworm on the U.S. economy. So these are two, very famous people that your listeners are very familiar with. None of your listeners consume health care. It consumes them. It's the only thing in their life where they don't know the value and the price of it, even after it's consumed. You know, tomorrow for people my age is Senior Citizen Day at Food Line. It's Senior Citizen Day on Thursday at Harris Teeter. People know how to consume if you give them the tools which to do so. The Clear Pricing Project is so simple. Get rid of secret contracts, push the power down to the consumer so the consumer can actually figure out the value and the quality of what they're getting in healthcare. And we are very pleased. We had 25,000 providers of healthcare. These are not live. These are actually 25,000 providers. One of these providers has 140,000 patients. The other one, ECU Physicians, has tens of thousands of patients. These providers said, yes, we want to be a part of the clear pricing. And the other thing clear pricing did is it increased the reimbursements to primary care physicians and mental health specialists, two areas that we think are closest to the health and the well-being of those people we have responsibility for, teachers, state employees, and others.
But the theory behind all this is that the state has enormous leverage. This is what happens in other countries where they have universal health care. They use their leverage to achieve the very goals you were looking for. It didn't work in our case here in the United States, in the state of North Carolina. Why can't we do that here?
Well, I disagree of the premise it didn't work. When we have 25,000 providers who said yes to We want to have transparent pricing, it's actually working. And therefore, for example, we're now altering our plan design starting next year. We're going to be reducing, in some instances, eliminating copays for people who are part of the clear pricing. This is as much economic as it is medical. We have a real opportunity in this state, being where we're physically located on the eastern seaboard. If we are known as the state with transparent health care, we have the potential of driving economic vitality, the likes of which no one has ever seen, but it can only be based on transparent health care cost. As you know, you've reported on this in the past, when I sent a request, for example, to UNC Healthcare to ask them, I know what we paid last year, I'm trying to figure out what we were supposed to pay. Our office received 168 black, redacted, completely redacted pages of the master charge list of what people pay for medical services. 20% of your listeners' income go towards something they don't consume. It consumes them. They don't understand the price and the value. And that's why you end up with surprise billing.
Well, is UNC Healthcare on board with this? Are they one of the signatories to your clear pricing plan going forward?
They're not, because the hospitals got together. Even hospitals that stood to be reimbursed at a higher rate, and the professor will know all about the economics of this, even the hospitals that were set to get higher reimbursements from the state health plan said no.
It's fascinating. I mean, and by the way, no less a figure than Michael Porter, who's the business guru at Harvard University and the Harvard Business Program there, wrote about this in the 1990s, saying that a lack of transparency in the way we do healthcare coverage in the United States of America is totally backwards for the reasons you said. People, consumers, aren't connected at all to the system the way they are in other countries where they have different kinds of systems. So it's fascinating that nobody disagrees with you, and yet you can't really have the largest healthcare systems in our state sign on because of their leverage. How do we change that?
Well, sometimes at UNCG, when my English professors, when I wasn't in the accounting school, said, you know, sometimes when you're struggling for the right word, maybe you should go to the dictionary or the Bible. And that's why it leads me to say this word. The word is cartel. If you go to the Webster's Dictionary, a cartel is an association which is formed to restrict competition and or raise prices. You know, we've all grown up hearing about the industrial complex. We now have a medical industrial complex in North Carolina and across the country. And really all we're trying to do on behalf of those that teach, protect, and otherwise serve is to get transparent health care so that our teachers, troopers, and other state employees can figure out the value and the cost of what they're getting. I'm actually extremely optimistic because of everything that's being said about this, whether it's the president's executive order about transparent health care billing or even Elizabeth Warren's admonition in the presidential debates when she said that rising health care costs are the leading causes of bankruptcy in the United States. I mean, these are all issues, and it's disproportionately on the backs of lower-income and fixed-income people. Disproportionately, higher health care costs are on the backs of lower-income and fixed-income individuals who can least afford to get sick.
When you talk about a cartel, though, that's antithetical to a free market system and a free market economy. And we were told that we can't go to national health care because that would destroy our free market system. But you're saying cartel, that's not free market. Do we have a free market system?
We don't have a free market system when you see the consolidation of health care in North Carolina in the hands of fewer and fewer people. There's actually, on page 14 of the little pocket constitution that I carry around, it said perpetuities and the extension of monopolies is against the free will of people. It's actually in the North Carolina Constitution about monopolistic actions against the free will of people. And that's why the state health plan, on behalf of those, is trying to take advantage of our largeness. We've done it in so many ways. We just renegotiated a fantastic contract for our retirees over the age of 65. But we are continuing to take advantage of our largeness. And to put this in context for your listeners, this state health plan has about as many participants as the people who work for Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway, Jamie Dimon's J.P. Morgan, and Jeff Bezos's Amazon. If you combine the employment base of those three companies in the United States, that is about the context of how many people are in the state health plan, nearly 720,000.
And you talked about the fact that when it's we don't have transparent pricing and the rest, the added costs are disproportionately felt by people at the lower end of the economic scale, which brings us to Medicaid and Medicaid expansion, another health-related debate. Long-term implications for the state budget. More and more states continue to sign on. Oklahoma earlier this year. North Carolina is now one of just 12 states that have not expanded Medicaid. Do you foresee expansion?
Well, that is a epic battle that's been going on between the legislature and the governor for some period of time. But when you look at the basics of Medicaid expansion, and you can look at what we're trying to do on behalf of those that teach, protect, and serve, what we're trying to do is we're trying to bring transparency, access, affordable, high quality health care to those that we have the responsibility for at the Treasurer's Office. So in that respect, bringing access and affordability to health care is something that we do every day within the state health plan.
Let me ask you about this in these times now. COVID-19 obviously has presented the state with pressing financial challenges. How does your office approach providing financial support and even maintaining? I mean, I'm looking at Wall Street. Things feel like they're in a bubble, and so much of what you do depends on what's happening in Wall Street. How do you manage the portfolio sort of standing at the edge of the precipice like this?
Well, in so many respects, we're priced for perfection. And, you know, as smart as our members are, those that teach, protect, and otherwise serve, they don't wake up thinking about AAA bond ratings, assume rates of return, life expectancies, asset allocation models, because at the end of the day, we're in the check delivery business. They work for this benefit, and they have earned this benefit, and they want this check for this and the next generation of public service workers. So we're here to preserve, strengthen, and sustain this plan for the next generation. But what you brought up is something that's very much a fear in my mind, is that as much attention has been spent on flattening the healthcare curve, and as a person who was hospitalized for nearly 6 days at the end of March with COVID-19, I appreciate the flattening of the healthcare curve, but the flattening or lack of flattening of this economic curve has a potential of widening and even creating an economic inequalities, the likes of which we've never seen in North Carolina. And my best way of explaining that is that we have two towns in the southern part of our state. One's called Charlotte and one's called Charlotte. They're spelled and they sound similar. But I can tell you that Charlotte and Charlotte are in far different boats as they attempt to flatten the economic curve facing their communities.
Well, and if we flatten out economically and financially, and there is if this bubble doesn't continue, both may be in the same boat in the months ahead. If we can't sort of continue the cash flow that has somehow kept Wall Street floating while the rest of the businesses seem to be stagnant. I wonder, what about at the moment, if you took a snapshot, how has COVID-19 affected state revenue?
Well, your listeners, because of the great information that you bring them every day, has heard that the state is facing somewhere between a $3 and $3.5 billion shortfall. We're in a fairly good position as long as we get the policies right to pull out of this better and stronger than any state our size. But the policies have to be transparent. We have to have the ability to challenge assumptions. We have to look at data. And whatever policies come out, we need to make sure that they're consistent. You know, sometimes one size doesn't fit all. Sometimes one size fits none. So we're facing a budget shortfall, but we have over $2 billion left from the previous year's budget. We have $1 billion in the rainy day fund. And even though I'm no longer in charge of the unemployment system, there's nearly over $2.5 billion in the unemployment trust fund to pay out unemployment benefits, which is a far different picture from 7 years ago when we had $2.5 billion in debt. And that's really important for your listeners because there are some states that are bordering us that are going to run out of unemployment trust fund money, and they're going to have to increase the payroll taxes on their employers in their states. And at the same time, they're asking them to retain or recruit employees. So I wouldn't trade places with any other state treasurer in the United States, but we have to get the policies right.
I'm going to put one more question to Chris Cooper before we close. Chris Cooper at Western Carolina University. Given what we just heard, we took a close look at the treasurer's office. We took a broader look at the other Council of State offices. Is there a way that we should be bringing more attention to these races and to these positions, do you think? And is there a practical way to do it in an election season?
You know, I think shows like this have a lot to do with it, and I would just ask folks to take advantage of the time we have, right? We've covered a lot, the massive rise in mail-in requests that we've received. One of the advantages of mail-in voting is that we can think of it kind of like an open book test, right? You can actually sit down at your dining room table, do some research, actually figure out what you think about these folks while you're casting your vote. So I would say let's take advantage of this opportunity.
Chris Cooper, Department Head of Politics, Political Science, and Public Affairs at Western Carolina University. Chris, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks. Enjoyed it.
Dale Falwell is the Treasurer of the State of North Carolina. Dale, always a pleasure. Thank you for talking with us.
Well, thank you. And people go to nctreasurer.com to find out more.
You can find out more about our show at our website, stateofthings.org. I'm Frank Stachow.